Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And it's an extraordinary moment when a former U.S. Attorney General goes on television and says the current U.S. Attorney General can't be trusted to uphold the rule of law. But that's what happened last night when Obama Attorney General Eric Holder was on MSNBC with Chris Hayes. They were discussing how Justice Department independence is not in the Constitution. It's merely a norm. And that means it depends on individuals to uphold the standards that until now you have probably taken for granted. Holder was asked if he has faith in Jeff Sessions to maintain Justice Department independence from Donald Trump.
I worry a great deal. And
that's not a yes.
It's not a yes. And this is a very difficult thing for me to say. It's a very, very difficult thing for me to say. I'm not a person who likes to criticize my successors, predecessors, because I know how tough that job can be. And yet, the actions that he has taken in response to criticisms that he's received from the president, his desire, it appears to me, to curry favor with a president who views him disfavorably, worries me a great deal. I'm not at all certain that he has got the steel that an attorney general has to have. I mean, in my conference room, as Matt will know, you get to pick four attorneys general that you display. I had Elliot Richardson left two down to remind me that at some point an attorney general's got to say no to a president, and maybe you're going to lose your job as a result of that. And I don't have faith in Jeff Sessions that he would look at Elliot Richardson in the same way that I did.
Former Attorney General Eric Holder last night on MSNBC. He also said he's thinking about running for president. Holder's concern comes, of course, in the context of the Russia investigation and the raid by the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York on Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer or non-lawyer fixer or whatever he actually is. And we will start there today with Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine staff writer, weekly co-host of the Slate Political Gabfest, and Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law at the Yale Law School. Emily, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on again. Can you say first that a strong sign of health of justice system independence is the raid on Michael Cohen approved by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Manhattan?
Yes, I do think that is a sign of health. And we've been told that the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, the interim U.S. attorney, recused himself, that Rod Rosenstein in the Department of Justice, the number two there, approved this raid. And it was carried out by prosecutors in the Southern District, a different unit from special counsel Robert Mueller. And so, you know, what, assuming the government had a good reason, had probable cause for this raid, and it was conducted properly, what we're seeing is prosecutors doing their job, despite a lot of pressure from Trump to lay off.
How much do you share Holder's concern in general? You heard that clip.
Well, I mean, I understand why Holder is worried. I mean, it feels to me right now like rule of law is holding, but every time we see, Trump attack Mueller and the independence of the Justice Department, and we see Sessions make a move that seems like it could be motivated to placate Trump, that's really not how we imagine the relationship between the White House and the Justice Department. And I think what we're seeing is a lot of strain on norms. The Justice Department is ultimately under the control of the president, but at least since Watergate, we've had this set of expectations that the president doesn't interfere with federal investigations, especially if they touch on his administration. And I think we're seeing those norms erode, obviously.
And they were talking on Chris Hayes and Eric Holder were talking with each other about how there was no Justice Department until sometime in the 19th century, and it's not in the Constitution. So there really is only a set of norms rather than a set of laws about much of the rule of law, at least where a president's potentially illegal or autocratic behavior is concerned. How much do you agree with that?
Well, I think you're right, certainly, that the Justice Department's not provided for in the Constitution, and it wasn't there since the nation's founding. But it's gotten stronger and stronger, and really, in the sort of post or the FDR era, we started seeing this big institution in Washington with this task of federal law enforcement and was centralizing federal law enforcement. And we've gotten used to that idea that we have a very strong institution there that is both part of the executive branch, but at times is able to maintain some distance from it. We had a big test with Watergate. We had another test with the Ken Starr's investigation of Bill Clinton. And I think it's hard to figure out for any country exactly how to separate powers and balance the competing values of having the centralized control and having the Justice Department under the president, but at the same time have no one above the rule of law, have some ability to investigate the president and the people around him. And we're seeing a kind of this is our latest sort of bite at the apple, and the and given the context and some of Trump's predilections, I think we're seeing that it can be kind of shaky and we haven't quite figured it out.
My guest is law watcher, Supreme Court watcher, and we'll get to Supreme Court cases, a few of them that are currently very interesting as we go, with Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine staff writer, fellow at the Yale Law School, and weekly participant in Slate's Political Gabfest at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Emily, it's been 9 days now since the Michael Cohen raid, and it's still arguably the biggest story in Washington, except maybe now for Pompeo meeting with Kim Jong-un. But is it persistently big just because it's sensational, or how significant is this Cohen investigation to the legal status of the president, do you think?
I mean, it's important for sure, and it could become incredibly important. We don't know yet. You know, as a lot of commentators have pointed out, this is not a step that investigators and prosecutors take lightly, to go raid a lawyer's office, especially when that lawyer's primary client, indeed one of his only clients, is the president. You have to really pass through many layers of approval. You have to show a judge that you have no other way of getting this information that you think is secure, because you're worried someone might destroy it. And so all of those hurdles portend poorly for Michael Cohen and perhaps for Trump. But we don't know exactly the scope of what the investigators are looking for. They're still hashing out in court how the prosecutors are going to be able to look through this information while respecting attorney-client privilege. Judge Kimba Wood is, you know, sort of sorting that out. And so this is really like the beginning of the legal story, at least in terms of what the public really understands and knows.
Can you think of any other time that a lawyer for a president was raided by the FBI and their lawyer-client confidentiality called into question by the president's own Justice Department?
No, I cannot. I didn't go back and look through the history books, but I think if there was a precedent, someone would have pointed it out by now. I mean, this is really a remarkable event. And, you know, all the incentives line up against President Trump's Justice Department doing this kind of thing. Like, they must have really felt like they didn't have a choice. And then the question will be whether they're wise to pursue this particular line of inquiry and investigation. And we just don't know enough yet about what they think Michael Cohen has done.
You know, listeners, I want to open up the phones for lawyers. I really want to hear from lawyers over the next few minutes. Lawyers, have at it here on how you view Michael Cohen, lawyer, non-lawyer. What would you say? How you view the attorney-client privilege wall, which a lot of us non-lawyers are getting an education on in the last 9 days, and how you view the Justice Department right now, for that matter, and the norm of Justice Department independence. Are you concerned like Eric Holder? But lawyers, Trump's tweets, and I realize that he says anything that's in his interest, untethered to any truth, is that lawyers everywhere are concerned by this raid on Trump's lawyer and this blurring of the line that the government is pursuing between what's legal work and what's not. How unusual is this? Attorneys in the audience, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Trump says lawyer-client privilege is dead. That's obviously hyperbole. But are you concerned at all as a lawyer about what's going on here? Or how would you explain it to the non-lawyers in the audience so that they can understand it better beyond the this is terrible on one side versus this is terrible on the other side? hyperbole that we hear in a lot of political commentary. 212-433-WNYC. Lawyers, help us out here. 212-433-9692. I'm not going to pay you a retainer, as I think Sean Hannity said, but I will just ask you for legal advice. I don't know if that makes you my lawyer or not my lawyer, but help us out here, lawyers. 212-433-WNYC, as Emily Bazelon, with her law degree and legal journalism experience, does so too. 212-433-9692. Emily, are you concerned at all, as a lawyer and legal scholar, that the government is setting any kind of dangerous precedent with that raid on those grounds and the way they're going to parse the material now of all Cohen's written communication with various clients? If you take who the players are and what their, you know, sort of crimes against democracy are, as you probably perceive them, out of the equation, just what the justice system is doing here in this case. Any concern?
You mean the fact that this raid took place and there's this, you know, potentially invasive action going into this attorney-client privilege?
Correct.
I'm not concerned. And here's the reason. I mean, I reserve the right to change my judgment if we find out that these prosecutors overstepped, that they're chasing some, you know, tiny technical infraction, et cetera. Sure, we could think about this. But, you know, when I worry about prosecutors being overzealous and overstepping their bounds, it is not a situation in which everything is being highly scrutinized. We have, you know, this very prominent figure being investigated. What I worry about are the cases that never make the news, where you have, you know, usually poor people having their rights infringed on and no one's really paying any attention. So in the kind of spectrum of, you know, prosecutorial aggression, the chances that these folks are way out of line seems really rather low to me. And we'll see. We just need more information to really make a judgment.
And of course, the raid was signed off on by Rod Rosenstein, a Trump appointee, the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, run by a Trump appointee, and this federal judge who approved both the search warrant and the court's right to see everything, not subject to selection by Cohen and Trump, which is what they were asking for on Monday. Did Cohen and Trump really think they would be given the privilege while being investigated of deciding what the court sees?
No, I can't imagine they really thought that was a plausible argument, but I think their lawyers had to say something and had to seem as if they were doing the best they could to aggressively protect their clients' rights.
How would you compare Cohen's request to Hillary Clinton deciding on her own to destroy 33,000 emails from her server because she alone declared them personal, not State Department related, no independent vetting of that? The Republicans bring that up over and over again.
Right. I mean, I think Hillary Clinton made a mistake in that moment. She had this idea. She had this separate sphere. But given the way she was using her server, you know, for appearances sake, if nothing else, she shouldn't have deleted those emails. It was, you know, it was an error and it cost her dearly.
The actual U.S. attorney in New York in that position temporarily as appointed by Trump, Mr. Berman, while they seek to fill the position permanently after Trump fired Preet Bharara, the Trump appointee acting U.S. attorney recused himself from the Michael Cohen case. Do you understand why?
No, I don't think we do know why. I mean, we know that he was a contributor to Republican candidates, I think including President Trump, if I remember
correctly. Right.
But,
I think that's right.
Right? But none of the things that I've read so far make it clear why there would be. And I believe he said it was an appearance of conflict of interest. So that little wrinkle there. I don't think we really understand that decision. He is, I suppose we should also say, a former law partner of Rudy Giuliani. But that in itself doesn't explain it either.
Let's take a phone call from an attorney, Karen, in Miami. You're on WNYC. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Karen. Hi, Karen. Hi, Brian.
You're Karen.
I wanted to say I enjoyed very much bringing in the green space with you yesterday, and thank you for the privilege of being there. To respond
and
to
wait, in between yesterday morning and now, you went to Miami?
Yes, I flew to Miami. I'm calling you from Miami now.
Okay.
I wanted to speak to the issue of the attorney-client privilege. The attorney-client privilege, and I do work as an expert witness in legal ethics in the legal malpractice cases, so I've had some exposure to the issue. The attorney-client privilege protects only communications between an attorney and another person seeking legal advice, in which that attorney hears the question or he hears the request for legal advice and responds to it with legal advice, or communications related to legal services by an attorney to that person.
What constitutes legal let you finish that whole thought, but what constitutes what you call legal advice or legal services?
It does not necessarily require the retention by a person of a lawyer to sue another person or to go to court or to negotiate an agreement. Any legal services or any legal advice or any activity that assists a client in connection with a legal matter constitutes legal services. It does not, it's not relevant whether the other individual or company pays for those services. The attorney-client privilege protects the right of the person seeking legal advice, the privilege of the person seeking legal advice. Mm-hmm. It is not the privilege. It's not a right of the attorney. It protects the right of the person seeking legal advice to the confidentiality of all communications right. relating to that advice, and payment and formal retention is not relevant right. to the question of whether or not
they'd be in that context. Let me play you the Sean Hannity clip from his show, Karen, and get your take on this. Identified in court was Hannity as a third client of Michael Cohen, in addition to Trump and the now disgraced Republican Party official named Broidy, who Cohen also facilitated hush money to a woman for. Does this sound to you like Hannity was using him for legal services or not legal services? Listen.
Michael never represented me in any matter. I never retained him in the traditional sense as retaining a lawyer. I never received an invoice from Michael. I never paid legal fees to Michael. But I have occasionally had brief discussions with him about legal questions about which I wanted his input and perspective. And I assume that those conversations were attorney-client confidential.
So, Karen, how do you hear that? I mean, it sounds to me like Hannity's position seems to be, he's my lawyer, but I'm not his client. How do you hear it?
I hear it in two contexts, and I've heard this clip many times. I've heard it in the context of the non-attorney-client privilege issue of whether or not Hannity has an ethical or a professional duty as a journalist to have discussed that relationship with Cohen, with Fox News, and with the public. I've also thought about it in the context of the attorney-client. It's my understanding that if what Sean Hannity says is true, that in fact he had an attorney-client relationship with Cohen, regardless of the fact he claims he did not pay Cohen for those services, did not sign a formal engagement letter agreement with Cohen. The fact that Cohen didn't sign a formal engagement letter agreement with Hannity is Cohen's potential problem under the rules of professional conduct in New York, but that's a separate matter. As far as the attorney-client privilege is concerned, it sounds to me from that clip, if true, that in fact there was an attorney-client relationship and those communications, but only those communications, relating to Hannity's request for legal advice and Cohen's response to that request are protected by the attorney-client privilege unless what those questions amounted to were questions about assisting Hannity in covering up a crime that had already
right.
been committed.
Karen, I'm going to leave it there, and I really, really appreciate all your insight. And thanks for coming to the Green Space yesterday.
I'll be there again.
thank you very much. So, Emily Bazelon, let me get you, before we move on to other aspects, to weigh in on this. Two, if Hannity's position is kind of he's my lawyer but I'm not his client, I guess that way if people buy it, Cohen gets attorney-client privilege in court, and Hannity gets not fired for concealing conflict of interest in his commentary. How do you hear that in legal terms?
I mean, it just seems like he's trying to both protect himself and minimize his relationship with Cohen. It's like the perfect having your cake and eating it too. And, you know, Fox News has made it clear that they're not going to punish or even criticize Hannity for failing to disclose this relationship in all of the umbrage and outrage he's been expressing about the investigation of Trump and the raid of Cohen in particular. You know, it's it doesn't really pass the smell test.
I also gather that Cohen, since this raid on his office gives him new legal problems, has asked the court in the Stormy Daniels case to postpone the case that she's brought to allow her to be free of the nondisclosure agreement and talk legally about her relationship with Trump. And in so doing, Cohen's attorney cited Cohen's Fifth Amendment rights. Do you understand what that means in this context? Because when I hear taking the Fifth, when a layperson hears taking the Fifth, they're thinking, oh, he's trying to avoid, he's using the Constitution to try to avoid incriminating himself in court, which suggests that Cohen, through this filing, in some way is suggesting that he's guilty of a crime.
Right. I mean, or he's suggesting that he doesn't want to talk because he's worried he could implicate himself, right? Yes. I mean, the Fifth Amendment is our protection against self-incrimination. When you actually invoke it, you're saying, if I answered this question, I could get in legal criminal trouble, and I don't want to do that to myself. Him talking about the possibility of it, I think we want to be a little careful. It's not the same thing as actually invoking it. But yes, it was certainly an interesting connection that he was making between these two matters.
Does the evidence indicate to you what crime he might be trying to not incriminate himself on and how it relates to the president?
Well, it seems like there are certainly potential violations of campaign finance law here, right? I mean, if prosecutors could show that the payoffs to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, the other actress involved in this story, if those payoffs, that hush money was paid to help President Trump get elected and it wasn't reported, well, that's, you're not supposed to be able to make that kind of contribution to someone's campaign. That's what John Edwards got prosecuted for. So there's certainly that potential violation.
Emily Bazelon with us from the Yale Law School, New York Times staff writer, Slate Political Gabfest participant, and Allie in Westfield. You're on WNYC. Hello. Allie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
This is Allie Lopreet. I am an attorney in New Jersey. I represent clients that are victims of sexual harassment or sexual assault. And, you know, my comment on all of this is first that a nondisclosure agreement is not uncommon. I've been asked that by several people over the last few weeks based on what's in the news. But that dismantling it in this situation seems appropriate. And, you know, further, when we're speaking about the attorney-client privilege, it's not uncommon that the first way to try and dismantle that privilege is to, you know, basically question the attorney-client relationship. I see that very frequently. You know, that's a common thing, and it doesn't mean that we have lost the attorney-client privilege in this country. And I find that to be quite a broad-reaching and absurd claim that's been made, that just because this one instance, everyone is going to lose their attorney-client privilege. And I do feel a lot of clients come in and they ask me, you know, are our conversations still privileged? And the answer is yes, of course. it's not uncommon that if someone's claiming attorney-client privilege, that can be questioned, and it goes right to whether that relationship exists or not. But everyone else in the country is safe. Their attorney-client privilege is still strong.
Have you ever had to defend any questioning of whether your communication with a client was privileged? Was there any gray area that you have a story about?
Well, absolutely. You know, many times we have relatives of victims that testify regarding what happened to their loved one and how it's changed them. And many times the defense, the first thing they'll do is ask whether we represent that relative and whether we can ask them, you know, they want to find out what we told them. if we prepared them for their testimony. And, you know, it's we have to make the claim that, yes, we represent them for purposes of that lawsuit only. We might not have signed a retainer agreement with that person. That person individually is not paying us. But for purposes of, you know, that lawsuit in particular, we will represent, you know, a family member or another witness that comes forward to discuss what's happened to that victim or, you know, what they've gone through or what they witnessed. So that is something that does come up.
Let me ask you one other thing. Since you represent sexual assault and harassment victims, I think there's a push now with all that's been disclosed since the Me Too movement really broke out last October to do away with non-disclosure agreements or make them at least much, much more rare in cases of employment where somebody from a company harassed or sexually assaulted an employee and then that person leaves but signs some kind of an agreement. Have you participated in non-disclosure agreements as an attorney representing the victims? And what do you think about the whole institution of them?
Yes, I have. And I will say that a confidentiality clause is a standard part of pretty much every settlement agreement that's reached between a plaintiff and a defendant in the civil context. At least, you know, here in I practice in New Jersey, and I know it's similar in New York. And that I really don't see that going away. I really don't see that, you know, settling a claim not including a confidentiality agreement or a non-disclosure agreement. But I do think, you know, there are situations such as the one that's so prevalent in the news now, where it may be appropriate to dismantle that confidentiality agreement or to find, you know, exceptional circumstances where a non-disclosure no longer holds water, so to speak. And so I can see, you know, through maybe legislation or if something comes up to the Supreme Court, where there would be circumstances where a non-disclosure agreement could be invalidated. But in terms of it being included, I think that's always going to be a prerequisite to settlement. And it is very common. In pretty much every settlement I have, there's a confidentiality agreement.
Huh. Do you see it as just a matter of a power imbalance? That the perpetrators or whoever you're settling with have the power to impose this confidentiality on the victim and she generally doesn't want it? Or does it benefit both sides in your experience?
Well, that's a great question. It does come up very often when it comes time to resolve the matter if it's not going to go to trial. And I do explain to clients that it is usually a standard provision. But I think in certain circumstances, absolutely, it could be seen as an imbalance of power. And some clients do have a very hard time of accepting that. And in that case, you know, the case would go to trial or it would proceed and not settle. And, you know, a trial is a public forum where, you know, the client has a chance to be heard in court. Of course, there's always a significant risk going to trial. And so, you know, we usually do counsel clients to try and settle the matter before you get there. It's also very, very difficult for sexual assault, sexual harassment survivors to go through a trial and have to publicly recount, you know, the humiliation and the pain that they were put through. And so I do see that it is difficult for many people to accept a non-disclosure or a confidentiality agreement. But as the environment stands now, and as the law stands now, you know, I think it's something that's going to continue to be pushed for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another light to look at it, in that some of these victims and survivors also don't want their story to be front page news.
Right.
You know, sometimes that non-disclosure or that confidentiality agreement benefits them as well.
Allie, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate all the context you've given us.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm very excited about it. Thank you.
And we continue with legal affairs watcher Emily Bazelon. Emily, I want to bring up some wholly unrelated cases in our remaining time, because there's really some big news on other fronts. One is that the Supreme Court decided an immigration case yesterday having to do with deportation, and flash bulletin stopped the presses. Neil Gorsuch voted with the liberals. Is that an accurate statement?
That is an accurate statement. And it's a really interesting set of issues and positions here. Gorsuch wrote a separate concurrence, so he didn't join in the reasoning of the four liberals. This is a case about how the government can define what's called an aggravated crime. So essentially, there are a whole bunch of clearly delineated crimes that mean that affect your immigration status and allow the government to, you know, take you out of the country, to deport you. And then there's this kind of catch-all phrase in one of the federal statutes about an aggravated crime. And it's sort of not entirely clear, at least in the view of the Supreme Court, what the government meant by that. It could cover anything, an aggravated felony. You know, it's not something where you've necessarily committed an act of violence. It's about whether there was a substantial risk that physical force could have been used in the course of this particular crime. Mm-hmm. So Gorsuch said he thinks this is too vague. It's not clear what Congress meant, and it's a kind of libertarian stance that we shouldn't be allowing Congress to cover some, you know, vague, undefined territory, that we should make Congress spell out what it wants to be criminal in the context of an immigration proceeding.
So does this indicate to you anything surprising in a more global sense about Neil Gorsuch and what kind of Supreme Court justice he might turn out to be?
Well, I think that we kind of had an idea already that he had this streak. It's sort of like Justice Scalia, where there are certain things where you go back to, in your originalist framing, you go back to the Constitution and you think, like, did the framers really think that Congress could just sort of, without being super clear about it, you know, make this big category of criminal activity that then would have these really serious consequences for people? So I think that that part of Gorsuch's jurisprudence, we already had some indication of it, and this shows that he's serious about it. He really cares about it. I don't think we should interpret this decision as being something that has to do with having any hesitation about deporting immigrants. I don't think he cared about that part. I think he was worried about the vagueness of the law.
And I want to ask you about this lawsuit that's now been brought by families of the first graders killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, against the talk show host Alex Jones, who has repeatedly called it a hoax. Here is 5 seconds of Alex Jones.
But it took me about a year with Sandy Hook to come to grips with the fact that the whole thing was fake.
What's the legal issue? As horrified as people may be by just hearing Alex Jones, and for many of our listeners, that might be the first time you ever heard him, what's the legal issue here?
This is a defamation suit, and the argument here is that Alex Jones is accusing these families of lying and of committing fraud, and that that is kind of per se defamation, that on its face, being accused of being a liar and a fraudster is something that hurts your reputation, and that Alex Jones did this with reckless intent, that he had reason to know that what he was saying was itself a lie, and he kept saying it and kept damaging the reputations of these families. So that's the theory, and I think what's really interesting here is it's one of it's not the only new defamation suit in which families and people who've been wronged by news coverage are trying to strike back. We also have the family of Seth Rich suing Fox News over this retracted article that, you know, seems to have made up a whole conspiracy about the murder of Seth Rich, their son, in this way that was supposed to be damaging to the Democrats. So again, you see this very politicized kind of conspiracy mongering. You see people who are targets of that and hurt by that trying to hit back.
You said the lawsuit hangs on Jones's reckless intent. Now, Trump also talks about filing defamation suits, sometimes against the mainstream media for, you know, what he calls fake news. Should legitimate journalists and commentators be worried about defamation suits impinging on their right to free speech, right to express their opinion, if the families were to win this against Alex Jones?
You know, we have such strong First Amendment rights and protections against libel in this country. So, you know, when Trump was saying, has said at various points, like, I'm going to fix the libel laws. I think they're way too permissive. I'm going to make it easier for people to sue. We all scoffed at that as legal commentators and said, like, no, sorry, you don't have the power to do that. So that remains true. I think it is also fair for people who feel like lies are being spread about them deliberately and recklessly to have some recourse. Otherwise, we have no way of protecting our reputations at all. And so, you know, when speech crosses a line into just being utterly false and full of conspiracy mongering, and you have reason to think the speaker is doing that, knowing that they're spreading lies, I think you should be able to sue. And I don't think that journalists who are trying very hard to tell the truth should be worried that that sets a precedent that if they make a mistake, they will be on the hook.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest podcast, and the Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law at the Yale Law School. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.